ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Hope your summer's going well, whether you've managed to get some time off or you're working through. We're bringing you some of your favourite stories from the Life Matters back catalogue to keep you company. Today, ageing is something that's inevitable, but growing up is optional. At least, that's something we hear a lot. But how much can a good attitude or a few small changes positively impact the way we age? Over the next 2 days, I'm going to arm you with the facts and things you can do to age well. What does it look like? How is it something that you might make a reality? And as we head into a new year, those resolutions might make you think about the things you want to do better to get more life into each year, maybe even add a few to your timeline. Coming up, the hunt for the elixir of youth and the surprising link between healthy aging and photography. Good news for the snapper who spends every holiday, Christmas, New Year's, birthdays, lining everyone up for just one more photo. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, what age do you consider old? 90? 75? 40? It's one of those trick questions. Age is relative. But in the workplace, a report by the Australian Human Rights Commission and the Australian Human Resources Institute found almost one quarter of HR professionals now classify workers aged 51 to 55 as older. 2 years ago, only 10% of recruiters took that view. We want to look at living better for longer. For some people, that might look like following their passion through their career. So let's start by looking at the issue of ageism in the workplace and how to tackle it. I am joined by Leah Lambert, a career and interview coach from Relaunch Me, and Alicia Blackham, professor at Melbourne Law School. She studies age discrimination law and the consequences of ageing for workplaces. Leah, I'll start with you. Is it fair to label 51-year-olds as older?
Look, personally, I don't think 51 is old at all. I'm 51.
Okay, you're biased. You've just turned 50, right?
I have just turned 50. And I guess when I meet people, I don't even think about their age. I am looking at their energy levels, the skills that they bring, and mostly their attitude. And I think often younger people can appear much older, and in comparison, older people can appear quite young because they've got lots of energy and attitudes, a great attitude. So it's really about perception, as you said.
Right, that whole idea of like you're only as old as you feel. Alicia, how do you view your age in relation to your work?
So age is relative, as you say, and other studies have actually shown that our perception of older age increases as we ourselves age. So the older we are, the more older age is just on the horizon, right? It's maybe 10 or 20 years beyond our age right now. So our perception of older age does shift over time as well. And our perception as a society is shifting. It's also relative to our industry. So I work in higher education. It's a much older general kind of workforce population. People do tend to be older. Mm. So if you are young, that might be quite exceptional in higher education, for example, because training takes so long. So these things are relative. And I think so much depends on our experience of aging.
That's so true. I'm thinking about like when you're a teenager and you think 30 is just like, is there even a number bigger than that, you know? And now that I'm an adult and I look at my parents and I'm kind of like, oh, well, like people in their 60s and 70s are like young and awesome and maybe everyone's just young forever. It's absolutely perception, like you say. So what was your reaction, Alicia, to this Well, it's not really classification. It's really more a trend in what HR professionals are describing, but it's shifted a lot in just a couple of years.
Yeah, and I think one of the things to note is that we don't know exactly which HR professionals were answering this survey. So it could be that the demographic of the respondents just got younger between the surveys. So maybe this is a younger cohort of HR professionals who therefore see older age as an earlier age. So maybe this doesn't reflect a broader trend in society. Maybe it's just the survey, and we don't really know.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Leah Lambert from Relaunch Me and Professor Alicia Blackham from Melbourne Law School about a new survey that showed that a large chunk, nearly a quarter of HR professionals, classified anyone like from 51 up as older, and whether that feels right to you, what you think you bring to a workforce as a by definition, older employee. Ruth, you're 52 and you've just got a new job, but you applied for 35 jobs to get there.
Yes, which was a completely new experience for me. I've always got the first or second job I've applied for. And when you say, oh, what does an older worker bring? I bring exactly what I've always brought. That's the point, is that I haven't changed. In fact, I'm on top of my game. I've just got more skills than ever. So I was baffled as what was going on.
But, like, you're not saying, hi, I'm 52. I'm assuming maybe you are. Like, what?
That's right.
What is... Is it just people kind of looking at you and just clocking that you're not in your 30s or 40s anymore?
Well, I think also I proudly wear my grey hair and I feel like my energy should, you know, and my ideas should speak louder than that. But then I started to think, what is happening? What's the pattern? And, you know, I've also been recommended to hide things in my resume, you know, to suggest any kind of age reference, like take all the dates off. And, you know, that was just a very strange experience. Okay, so let's give that a whirl. So, yeah, I think it definitely contributed to what was going on. It was an experience I've just never had.
Well, Ruth, congrats on getting your job eventually. Thank you so much for the call. Leah, listening to Ruth's story there, she's never had a problem in the past. She's been given advice around dates on resumes, hair colour. What do you say when you're talking to clients in your work?
I am speaking to people like Ruth every day, and many people, I think 30 jobs is not a lot compared to other people who are applying for hundreds of jobs and not getting interviews and feeling very upset and frustrated. Majority of those people are people that have never had trouble finding jobs before. So I think there's two things happening. One is a lot of companies are using applicant tracking systems, which may be producing biased outcomes. So basically that means that there are automatic filters set up for scoring applicants and ranking them against information in their resumes. So that could be penalising older workers because there might be filters set on their year of graduation, their duration of career, etc. So that is one factor, and a lot of people are perhaps experiencing that they're getting screened out of the process before a human even lays eyes on their resume. The second thing I would say is that I'm having the same conversations with 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. The job market at the moment is just really tough. And I think what's happening is older workers immediately assume that the reason they're not getting interviews is because of their age, but younger workers are having the same challenges. And it's really mostly because there's a higher number of applicants in the market than there has been for a while. And that's probably the main reason. It may not be due to their age at all.
That's a really, I think, almost comforting bit of insight to be able to bring to this, that maybe it isn't you. Maybe it is. Maybe there is discrimination happening, but perhaps it's just the landscape we're in. It's so interesting what you say about filtering out experience, because I think that's really what this conversation's all about, is that that there are benefits for having a long career. Bernadette, you're over 60 and you've launched 4 tech startups.
That's right. And I agree 100% with what your prior speaker just said about Gen AI systems specifically. That's my area of research now. I and now in higher education. And prior to that, was in the tech industry doing digital platforms. And these Gen AI systems are being used, picked up by the HR industry. They've always been some of the first adopters of digital technologies, and there's absolutely bias in terms of what it's producing in terms of the outputs of what they're looking for. But what I had said to you, Keegan, was in my text in to you was that people over 60, I think, provide quite a bit of continuity in understanding history. So that in many cases in a company, in government, and in higher education for that matter, we don't continue a cycle of making stupid decisions over and over and over again. We bring some level of continuity and institutional memory that often gets lost when, respectfully, younger people think they are the first ones to have tackled a particular problem.
So you're bringing that organizational memory, that sort of long vision, and perhaps avoiding some traps for young players along the way. Bernadette, thank you so much for the call. Really appreciate your insights. Peter, you've also called in. Tell me about your older career story.
Yes, my son and I have invented a new device, which is a new tip for the mobility cane used by blind people. And it's a multi-directional, frictionless device, which is not available on the worldwide market. So at the age of 73, I'm vision impaired myself, and I've also got Parkinson's. I've found myself as a director of a company that's trying to market a product on the worldwide market.
Wow. So you really are taking names and getting stuff done in your 70s. Peter, thank you so much for the call and all the best with the business. Suze, you changed jobs at 60. What was that like?
It was kind of fun, to be honest.
That's nice. That's a really nice thing to hear. Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's nice to think that you're wanted. So it was a person I used to work with who had moved across to another company, and they kept saying to me, you know, there's a job here, it'd be great for you. And I was kind of happy where I was, but there was a new manager and I just could see some things up ahead. I thought, I don't know if this is going to work for me any longer. And so, yeah, I moved across and I've been there. It'll be 4 years next month. I haven't spent longer than, say, 6 years, 4 months in a job in my life. And I intend to keep working until it's your health and it's your mental health. You know, I still need to work financially. So I'm just trying to, and my skills are still good. Like the younger people in my area ask me to fix formatting issues in documents. I do presentations for boards and stuff like that. And it's just your attitude. I think if you relate to younger people, you're not patronising. I think that young people can be patronising to old people, and it works both ways. So if you just take people as you find them, I think they know that's a thing. So, yeah, I hope I will still be working into my 70s because I'd be bored and I need the money to travel. And so, yeah, I just think it's really everyone's different, you know, what your needs are and what you want to do. Some people can't wait to retire. But
you're going to work as long as you can.
I'm going to work as long as I can. And like recruiters, I haven't had to deal with recruiters much. I've worked in universities where you deal with the university directly, or I've worked with the federal government. So I've avoided recruiters.
Suze, thank you so much for the call. You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. Leah Lambert's with me. She's the founder of Relaunch Me. Leah, listening to those different stories from different people, I really get the impression that mindset and is a big factor here.
Absolutely. Most workers these days do want to continue to work in their 70s. And look, SEEK even put out a report earlier this year that tells that, you know, 38% of the 5,000 people who were surveyed that they all want to continue to work in their 70s, but probably the biggest reason is out of financial need, with mortgage debt, et cetera, cost of living. People believe that they do need to continue to work into their 70s. So people, if they're feeling that they're aging out at 51, that's a big disconnect between what we're hearing in terms of people are wanting to work well, you know, for at least into their late 60s. So, you know, that's going to be a real problem if employers continue to, you know, put this bias against older workers. So I think employers have an obligation to be looking at flexible working arrangements that will allow more older workers to continue to keep working as well.
I've also got Alicia Blackham, who's a professor at Melbourne Law School, with me. Alicia, does deeming 51-year-olds as older impact hiring practices?
It's very possible that it will. And I guess, you know, we do have quite strong age bias in the workplace still. We've had federal age discrimination laws since 2004. So it is unlawful to discriminate on the basis of age, including in recruitment. But these underlying age assumptions and stereotypes, they still continue in the workplace. And one of the really challenging things for older workers relates to assumptions about technology. As we've heard from our callers today, so many older workers are really up to date with technology. They're doing amazing things in the technology space. But if we assume that older workers can't use technology, that might impact on recruitment.
Mm. And Leah, sometimes it's about the way people perceive themselves, almost that, like that internalized age bias. They're kind of mentioning it to you when they're coming to you.
That's often the first thing people say when they call me is, instead of saying I'm an engineer or an accountant, they'll say I'm a 51-year-old male. Mm-hmm. So I believe it is at the top of people's minds. And perhaps that is, as I mentioned before, just the state of the market, that people are more conscious about their age because the people that are coming to me are finding it often difficult to find a job. So they're assuming that it's age-related. But, you know, instead it's about, I guess, also presenting themselves on paper in a way that doesn't make them look old. And so I think often candidates are using the same resumes that they used 10 or 15 years ago. You know, even how they present themselves has changed a lot, even in the last 10 years. So I think it's really important for older workers and job seekers to make sure that they've got contemporary documents, that they are up to date with current recruitment practices, so that they won't be that perception of being older, you know, that they, when they're someone's reviewing their resume, they're not getting that perception's not coming across.
Sebi, you're 53 and you've gone back to uni.
I have. Hi, Tegan. How are you?
I'm great. Tell me your story.
Well, I have always worked. I've been working since I was like 15. You know, I've done corporate, I've done, you know, the small, medium business. And then I decided to change career. I wasn't qualified in anything. And, you know, I'm doing my master now. So I just finished the undergrad last year. And I thought that's not enough to give me the qualifications to work in the, you know, the job role that I would like to. So I decided to do the Master of Environment. And I've had a mix of like reactions from, you know, family and friends. Some are saying, oh, you're going to be overqualified. Others are saying you're going to be too old. Mm. And I don't feel old. I feel like, you know, I'll have all the knowledge. I just need someone to believe in me and, you know, so that I can actually get the skills in that job, because I know I can do it. But, you know, it's the unknown, I guess, and that's the thing that's worrying me.
Yeah, to go and go to uni is really to take a leap of faith. It sounds like you're going to have an incredible combination of life experience and qualifications. Sebi, thank you so much for the call. Dennis, you're 85 and you're only just starting to feel old now.
Yes, exactly, Tegan. Love your show and been following you since the health report. So I may be a bit of a stalker on the radio, I think. But anyway, at 85, I don't think anybody's going to catch me or I won't catch them. But no, I work with a pharmaceutical company called Aspen, and they employed elderly people, and I worked up till I was 76. So, but the only thing that makes you old is in your head, because my head says that I'm okay, even though I'm partially blind and I walk on crutches. I do get out all the time as much as I can, and I keep myself active, but yeah, sometimes your body is screaming out, you are old, and face up to it.
The disconnect between the body and the brain. Dennis, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate it. And before I got a call from Bernadette, who was talking about being in her 60s, having started four tech startups, talking about just the benefit of the long view that older workers can bring in the workplace, Sandra has texted in saying yes, yes, yes to Bernadette. Laura Tingle wrote an excellent quarterly essay about lack of memory in the public service and some other areas some time ago. Older people have so much to contribute, especially memory of what does not work. Well, Leah, I want to come back to you on what you were saying before about CVs and how people present themselves when they are going for jobs, because you sort of hinted at the idea that people are unintentionally, maybe not aging themselves, but appearing out of date in how they present themselves. What are some practical tips for making sure that you are presenting yourself in a contemporary way?
I guess one of the first things that is that resumes these days are really like a marketing document. So they're probably 2 to 3 pages long. So if you have a resume that's 4 or more pages, 4 probably absolute maximum for someone who's a really senior executive candidate. But if you have a resume that's longer than that, that would be automatically considered a little old school. Resumes these days, we probably would focus on the detail of your experience, the last 3 roles or the last sort of 10 to 15 years. So again, all the detail going back further than that is just not considered relevant anymore. And again, the even just the look and feel of your resume, you need a more contemporary template that really stands out, because recruiters these days are reviewing resumes online. So a little bit of colour, some nice bold headings, some bullet points that jump off the page and will capture the attention. And probably the final thing, because so many organisations are using these applicant tracking systems, what that means is they're screening the information in your resume against position descriptions and job ads. And so it's really important that you are tailoring your resume for every job and also including a lot of the keywords from the job ad and the position description in your resume.
Okay, so sort of SEO, search engine or AI optimizing your CV as well. Martin, you've got a theory of why some employers are hesitant to employ so-called older workers.
Yeah, my theory is that they think they won't stick around because they're older. Whereas now, I've been through the retrenchment process several times in my career. I'm 67, I've just retired. They think they won't stick around, but when I was going through the recruitment process before, they said, if you had a job for 5 years, then you're doing well. Mm. So if you're 50, you've got at least 17 years of working life ahead of you before you can even think about retiring.
Yeah, no one's sticking in jobs for 20 years in the same way that they might have a generation or two ago. It's such a good point. Martin, thank you so much for the call. And I want to ask you about this, Alicia. With ageism and age discrimination, really what this conversation has illustrated to me is that it's pretty much groundless. Like, people are willing to work. They've got the skills. They want to work. Sticking around in a job for a long time, you know, decades or more, perhaps isn't a relevant part of society. What are we seeing in the law around age discrimination cases?
Yeah, and so we do have a legal framework that prohibits age discrimination, but it's really rarely used by older workers or by younger workers to challenge these practices in the workplace. And that might be for a few reasons. The law can be complicated. It's meant to be accessible, but it can be hard to access. And in the past, it's been potentially expensive to bring a claim. There have been reforms in recent years that have made the laws more accessible. And we've just had the first successful claim under the federal age discrimination laws challenging essentially a forced retirement. So I think the law is slowly moving to match these trends in the workplace, and it's becoming easier over time to challenge these behaviours where they are discriminatory.
There's another thing I want to put to you from a couple of texts that I've gotten. One person says, I experienced ageism 6 years ago at 44. Employers wanted experience, but with junior salaries. Another person, Susanna, says, I have the good fortune at 70 years old to be employed by a company that values my experience. I wonder if for some employers, the idea that over 50 is seen as old is because these people have extensive experience and therefore want to be paid appropriately. Are we just too expensive from the employer's point of view? Alicia, is there anything in this?
So based on the AHRC survey that we're talking about today, I think there is something to that. A number of respondents said that they thought older workers might be too experienced or that they might be too expensive. So I think there is a kernel of truth to what people are thinking or experiencing. Interestingly, HR professionals also said they thought young people would be too expensive. So I think age discrimination applies not just to older workers, but also against younger workers. And to be honest, we have more in common across these age groups and our experiences of work than we might think.
Okay, so we're sort of making a mountain out of a molehill?
Potentially, but I think people's experiences are really real here. And I think part of this is about opening up HR professionals' understanding of the value that we bring to work at all ages and trying to dispel some of these really harmful stereotypes and assumptions about age and aging.
Leah, from your perspective in the, well, you're not a recruiter, you're helping people get recruited. What do you think would be good to shift?
I believe there is a problem with people in the workforce as they get older being told that they're overqualified. And I think the challenge with that is often older workers, as they do get older, they are wanting a more flexible balance. They may not want as much stress as they have previously. And a number of my clients have made very deliberate decisions to try and reduce that stress by taking a role with less responsibility. But when they're applying for those roles, they're being told that they are overqualified. So organisations need to be perhaps more considerate and really thinking about the value that older workers can bring, like many of the things that we've talked about earlier in this conversation. I think they need to remove some of the language from their job ads that suggests they want younger people, like words like digital native, for example, which suggests they want a younger person. And I think they need to be really monitoring those applicant tracking system algorithms to make sure that we are not screening these older workers out of these processes before they even have a human assessment or human eyes on their resume.
Thanks, Leah. That was Leah Lambert, a career and interview coach from Relaunch Me. You also heard from Alicia Blackham, professor at Melbourne Law School. And thank you for your texts. One person says, us oldies bring life and job experience, reliability, and we're surrogate mums and grannies to our colleagues. Another says, I'm an old teacher. I'm resilient, polite, skilled, reliable, and funny. I'm not bragging, but I far outshine many of my younger colleagues who are a bit work shy. Lisa says, when I was younger, I planned to work for as long as I was alive, but at the age of 67, being in a high-stress job structured around deadlines and monetary targets, I decided to retire instead of having a stroke. I love not having all the work pressures. I'm free to help family and friends when they need it. When did working forever become the only way to be productive? Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, because next we'll be talking about the hunt for eternal youth and the massive prize for the first scientist to unearth the elusive secret.
Christopher Skase was charming,
audacious,
powerfully charismatic.
Christopher Skase had it all. A beautiful wife, great hair, and a $1 billion empire. It's almost as if it was
too good to be true.
Too good to be true.
Well, it was.
The largest corporate collapse in Australian history.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Once you've got more money than you know what to do with, wouldn't you want all the time in the world? Billionaires are now funding a race against time itself. Currently, A $101 million prize is on the table for the entrepreneur who can create an elixir of youth. So as the rich list line up at the fountain of eternal life, how are those without $1 billion in the bank trying to cash in on this new medical frontier? And when is trying to stop the clock on aging taking it too far? How can we appreciate age and the good things it brings, wisdom and understanding? Well, in a moment, you'll hear from a clinical psychologist who says our obsession with aging is rooted in our fear of dying. But first, let's take a look at this new world of anti-aging technology. Dr. Lindsay Wu is a senior research fellow with the Laboratory for Aging Research at the University of New South Wales. Lindsay, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So what's this $101 million anti-aging competition all about?
Yeah, so this was set up by the XPRIZE Foundation, and essentially it's awarding $101 million to whoever can show that they can extend health span and ideally lifespan in humans. We've got lots of interventions that extend lifespan in lab rats or lab mice and other animal species, but of course translating that into humans is a lot more difficult, and that's what this prize is about.
It's very hard to measure a really big increase in lifespan in humans because the experiments take forever.
Yeah, by definition, it's the longest and most expensive clinical trial you could ever run. And so, you know, this is why we're having to rely on these, you know, proximal markers for aging itself. And this has really been an issue for the field.
So the competition's being backed financially by the founder of the athleisure brand Lululemon and a foundation called the Hevolution Foundation, which, full disclosure, you have actually received funding from. Why are these brands and foundations in this space?
So I can't speak for the motivation of the Lululemon founder other than I thank him for funding research in the field. Hevolution is a Saudi-backed philanthropic and commercial organization that's investing in technologies and drug therapies to extend lifespan. And, you know, it's a fairly obvious motivation. If we can extend human lifespan, of course, everyone wants to live longer, but we could also treat a ton of age-related diseases at the same time. You know, the risk of every single disease that we have expands exponentially with old age. And so it's not just about, you know, this greedy obsession of living longer. It's a serious public health goal. This therapy that improves health span and attacks the biology of aging could go after a ton of age-related diseases and chronic diseases, I should say.
I do want to get into the public health side of this in a minute. But first, let's just get a bit of a sense of who's in the field because the semi-finalists have been announced. What kind of ideas are they putting forward?
Yeah, there's all sorts of different technologies. You know, there are drug-based technologies, there's AI platforms, there are diagnostics. You know, my own research is mostly involved with drug-based interventions to try and extend lifespan. It does seem sort of science fiction that there could be drugs that we could take to extend lifespan, but, you know, there is decent evidence in animal models that there are certain drugs or formulations that can improve late life health and overall lifespan. You know, one of those drugs, for example, is currently used in the clinic as for transplant recipients.
Okay, that's really interesting. So you're listening to Life Matters on Radio National, and I'm Tegan Taylor. And I'm interested to know if you think we're too obsessed with staying young. Anne in Canberra says, I'm 43, which is by no means old. However, I would not swap myself now for my 20-year-old self. I'm loving the self-confidence, self-awareness and knowledge and experience I have now, even with the grey hair and wrinkles starting to appear. Another question from Stephen in Taz saying, do these ageing treatments actually increase longevity or do they just make you look younger? Lindsay, let's talk about what the aim is here because there's some fine print with this study or with this funding stream. The winner's treatment must restore muscle, cognitive and immune function for a minimum of 20 years, for a minimum of 10 years with a goal of 20 years. What are the focus points of the kind of anti-ageing that you're going for?
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed earlier, the trial to run measure human lifespan is very difficult, right? So we have to rely on these nearest term goals. So we know that as old people get older, they lose their muscle strength, and that is really important for their quality of life later on. You know, it causes people to fall over and break their hips. So that's why there's a goal of maintaining muscle strength. We also know that, for example, older people don't respond as well to vaccines, and they're at higher risk of, you know, respiratory diseases or respiratory infections. And so that's why this prize, this foundation, is measuring some of those proximal things that occur as we grow older. One of the other things they're measuring is the changes in the patterns of how our DNA is turned on and off, something called DNA methylation or epigenetics. There is sort of this epigenetic clock inside our DNA that ticks as we grow older, and that clock can go faster or slower in certain people. So that's what this foundation is sort of using as its benchmark for success.
I do want to talk about the equity side of things. So a lot of the focus in this area is around billionaires who are, you know, injecting themselves with young people's plasma and stuff like that. It's a very rarefied space. Those sorts of things might extend the life of one or two very, very rich people, but there's still millions, billions of people worldwide who don't have access to basic medical care. How do we ensure that this conversation includes an equity lens?
So the good news is that a lot of the, you know, the interventions that we know are good for late life health are very cheap. So, you know, having a balanced diet, getting lots of exercise, in particular resistance training in older people, is really important, and it's quite cheap to do. You know, we see things like cryogenic therapy where people buy these extremely expensive tanks to try and cool down their body and refresh themselves and live longer. But, you know, you can achieve the same result by having a cold shower or going for a swim. In terms of the drugs that are being developed, you know, the most promising drug candidates are generic compounds that are quite cheap. They're already used in the clinic. What we're lacking is a clinical trial data to say that they will work in humans. But, you know, once we have that data, those drugs are off patent and they're relatively cheap. So that could be a really promising way to, you know, to democratize or ensure that we have widespread access to these interventions.
Yeah, part of the problem with having the evidence is that doing the research to yield the evidence does cost money. Lindsay Wu, thank you so much for joining me.
No worries.
You're listening to Life Matters on Radio National. We're talking about the obsession with staying young, living forever. I'd love to know if you've done anything to try to live longer. Peter says, life extension is a rich world indulgent when such a high proportion of the world dies young. Kim says, isn't it about living well for longer? No one wants to live forever if they feel like the traditional 200-year-old, but if I can live without being dependent on medication and carers, yes, please. I like being alive. So let's get into what it is with this human obsession to live longer. It's certainly not a new concept. We've literally been talking about it for millennia. Rachel Menzies is a clinical psychologist and director of the Menzies Anxiety Centre and is author of the book Mortals, How the Fear of Death Shaped Modern Society. Rachel, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. Thanks for having me on.
So you've been looking at extreme cases of anti-aging. The current poster boy of this world is Brian Johnson. I think if you know who he is, you really, really know. But for those of us who perhaps aren't so familiar, what's his deal?
So Brian Johnson is a tech billionaire who has made it his life mission essentially to prevent and eliminate death. He undergoes various bizarre and experimental procedures, including things he used to inject his son's blood into him in a method of plasma transfusion. He takes about 100 supplements a day. He fasts for 18 hours a day. And his motto is don't die. So he's made the goal of his life pretty clear. And I think this reflects a broader societal problem with actually accepting death as a natural part of life.
Someone says, I'm 80, but not the stereotype. I don't look or feel 80. I'd like to think I have a much longer lifespan ahead, but let's face facts. We're greatly threatened by existential threat to our long-term future through this total ignoring of our ever-increasing heating planet. Would be more beneficial if these billionaires contributed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Jack says, the best thing about getting old is that I have accepted I'm going to die and I'm not scared of dying. Well, Rachel, being scared of dying is a really big part of your practice. How do you sort of deal with people who are afraid of death?
So at the Menzies Anxiety Centre, that's really our big focus. We focus on helping people cultivate greater acceptance of death and living a life that they feel is more meaningful. Part of that therapy involves evidence-based treatments such as cognitive behaviour therapy to help get people facing reminders of death, engaging with the topic of death and mortality, rather than doing what humans typically do when it comes to things which make us anxious, which is avoid. Most people want to avoid thinking about death, avoid facing it, and we know that this actually makes anxiety about it worse.
What do you think this fear says about society more broadly?
I think this fear really reflects our desire to control and postpone the inevitable. I think all of us feel that we are unique individuals whose lives should be important and significant, and it's really hard then to face death. It seems like death is unfair, or it just shouldn't happen. I think it's very difficult for us to accept that we are mortal beings, that we are animals, and that we are destined to die.
On the text line, one person says, my father-in-law is one of the XPRIZE finalists. He uses exosomes, which are cellular messengers, and is based in Mudgee in New South Wales. As a finalist, he's received $250,000 to develop the concept. Well, congratulations there. I'd love to come back to Lindsay. The fear of dying is a reason to try and stop the clock. Can we reset on some of the boring things that we know are linked with a long and healthy life?
Yeah, so we know there are various things we can do to live a long and healthy life. And of course, things like regular exercise, healthy diet, good sleep, all of these are cornerstones of physical health and, of course, mental health. But I think we get ourselves into a bit of trouble when we're focusing a lot of effort on living longer and not as much effort or energy in living a more peaceful, wiser life with better psychological well-being.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Menzies is a lecturer at the University of Sydney and director of the Menzies Anxiety Centre. You also heard from Dr. Lindsay Wu, who's a senior research fellow with the Laboratory for Ageing Research at the University of New South Wales. And on the text line, Peter says, I've always eaten wholesome foods, that is, no processed foods, educated myself in all aspects of my life to reduce my stress levels, and most of all, being independent. Another person says, I love getting old. I love it. Finally, old and brave enough to sit on the back of a motorbike while touring around Iceland. It took my breath away. So different, so in touch with the world. Well, coming up here on Life Matters, the surprising link between photography and mental well-being in older Australians.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Children's author Andy Griffiths.
Hello.
Springsteen. He walked out and the audience sang the first verse.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, good to be here.
Where are we in space and time?
From novels that spark the imagination
to discovering music that surprises and delights.
Explore the breadth and depth of Australia's cultural landscape
with ABC Radio National.
You know that one person who always insists on snapping a last-minute family photo, usually when everyone's half out the door or mid-eye roll? In fact, these sorts of people are probably in their element this time of year, snapping pics of every present being opened, the clinking of every celebratory drink. It can be a little annoying in the moment, but it turns out they might actually be onto something. Research suggests that taking photos, especially for older adults, can be surprisingly powerful. It's not just about capturing memories. It's about boosting mental well-being, improving overall health, and reconnecting with the world around you. Because when you stop to take a photo, you're really doing more than just clicking a button. You're slowing down, you're paying attention, you're noticing the beauty in the everyday. Well, Dr. Tricia King is a senior lecturer in photography at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Tricia, what is picking up a camera doing for us, especially later in life?
Morning, Tegan. Well, photography is really a perfect activity of all ages, but particularly for older people, because as you say, it forces us to slow down, to celebrate the small moments. And look, we know as we get older, there's a higher chance of isolation, depression, and decrease in movement and engagement. And photography can really work towards supporting an overall increase in quality of life through that mindfulness and through that everydayness of activity, allowing us to really see and celebrate the smaller moments and look at our whole world through a different lens and a different way of seeing.
A different lens, quite literally. What kind of things are you seeing people benefiting from most when they're taking these photos?
We're finding that, you know, photographs are really allowing that social connection between people. So it allows us, photographs are really there to be talked to. And so by creating photographs, we're finding a lot of people are really connecting socially, connecting to their place and being able to really explore things a whole bunch differently in the world.
So it's the taking of the photo, that's lovely, but then you're saying connecting through looking at photographs. I know for myself, my phone camera roll is like got thousands of photos in it and I never sit down and look at them again. I'm just taking the photo. How do we make sure we do both parts of this practice?
Well, really, when you're thinking about the older cohort of people particularly, we are from the generation where we used film and that was our photo creating practice. And so film was, as you might recall, quite expensive in the day. And so we would only take photographs of the most important moments of life and they were really quite special. We have the ability now to take photos, as you say, of absolutely everything. But I think with the older generation, there is a lot more of a curation of photographs and a lot more of display of photographs. And that's one thing that I think people every day should make sure to print out their photographs and display their photographs, because it really is about curating and selecting and then talking to photographs as well. And I noticed this when I was working particularly in residential aged care, that people take photographs throughout their entire life's journey. And so they would put photographs up on their wall as a way of connecting with other people. So it's really important, as you say, the act of slowing down and creating one as well, but making sure that we're pulling them off that camera roll, we're sharing them, whether it be in photography groups, whether it be when your relatives come over, or whether it be if you're in residential aged care, showing something on your camera phone to your nurse when they come into the room as well. And having that ability to talk to your images, and that's the way you really share your identity and you share your thoughts and you share your individuality, is by, you know, sharing your images and your thoughts about them.
And it's not just about people taking family photos, although that's a huge part of it. You also have observed that doing photography is a reason to get out of the house. It becomes an event.
That's exactly right. And we've had a lot of people. So we have recently started running photo walks where we're taking out groups of people, both in residential aged care and people living in community. And my proudest moment was when I turned around and I saw one gentleman photographing a weathered sticker on the side of an industrial bin behind a shopping complex, and another person leaning down and looking down the drain because they saw something really bright and shiny. So it's not about birthdays and big moments. It's about looking at the way that shadows fall. It's looking at tire tracks in the mud. And honestly, there's something special about noticing those small moments that hundreds of people walk past every day. You feel kind of special because you're the person who stopped and really paid attention to it as well. So, yeah, I think thinking about, you know, the different ways of connecting with life and thinking about these smaller moments that are really beautiful. It doesn't have to be all showy. It's quite nice small moments to look at.
Dr. Tricia King is a senior lecturer in photography at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Next up, your favourite scientist and how his relationship with money has changed over time. There isn't a question about how the world works that he can't answer, but can he talk taboo money questions? We're asking your favourite Australians about their relationship with money in our series My Two Cents. And this is someone whose voice will be instantly recognisable if you listen to lots of the ABC.
G'day, Dr. Carl here, Carl Kruszewski. And the way I make my money is complicated. I do work for the University of Sydney and the ABC, where I do about a dozen talkback science radios every week, and also write books, do a bit of speaking, and I think that's kind of it. When I got my very first pay, I spent it on petrol for my old VW, and that was way back when I was a labourer on the waterboard in Wollongong. The smallest purchase that brought me a huge amount of joy was when I spent about $30 on buying a set of 3,000 tiny, 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 I mean really tiny, stainless steel screws of every possible size and head configuration and length to to use in the arms of glasses. You know, the glasses you put on your face. Because when you lose a screw, you have to go and fork out another couple of $100. And I bought them for about $30. Out of my set of 3,000, I'm down to only 2,997. So if you happen to have lost the screw in your glasses, give me a ring and I'll be down to 2,996 and I'll be very happy to start using them. When I was growing up as a kid, money was pretty tight. We didn't have much cash. We had very little discretionary spending. I do remember being very sick on one occasion as a little child while at primary school, and I was incredibly thrilled that my father came home from work with a present for me, a cheap plastic pencil sharpener, which was in the shape of a jet bomber with a triangle wing, and it must cost maybe 2 or 5 cents. And it was just such an outlandishly expensive present to give to a very sick little boy. Now, the last time I worried about my bank balance was when I was about 25, and I had a degree in physics and maths, and I was a filmmaker, taxi driver, drug-crazed hippie, t-shirt maker, labourer, and at the age of 25, I had 30 cents in the bank. I was lucky enough to rehabilitate myself because I then lived in the squats in Sydney for 8 years without paying rent, and that saved my future pathway, and things would have gone bad, but they didn't, because I was able to study and not have to pay rent at the same time. And so I was able then to benefit from the fact that the Australian government once upon a time thought that education was a worthwhile investment in the future. And as a result, I was able to get 16 years of university education virtually for free. Thank you very much, people who believe that, and I still believe that. I have been gifted money from my family in an odd sort of way, in that I was an only child, and that left me my parents' house when they died, and that was the equivalent gifting. And I'm kind of thinking that part of the reason that we have a housing price crisis in Australia is that instead of seeing housing as a basic human right, we have somehow got into seeing it as an investment vehicle, which is kind of wrong, I think. The biggest thing I've had to unlearn, relearn about money, having become an adult, is to realise when you have enough. And this came to me when I was working as a medical doctor, which was a sort of a late career. I didn't start studying until I was 32 and didn't become a medical doctor till my late 30s. And you'd come across people who were dying, and you'd look at the bed and there'd be all these people around them that were different. They looked different. And so obviously they were dying and everybody was coming in to say their last goodbyes. And I'd talk with these people and keep them company. And overwhelmingly, most people never realise when they have enough. And most people never realise this until their last days, and they say things like, I wish I'd spent more time with my family. And luckily, I learned that before I got to my deathbed. The biggest decision I had to make about money was when I was working as a TV weatherman on Channel 10 on Good Morning Australia. And I said something, I did a story about how to make a New England Journal of Medicine burger. It was a bit of a kind of joke article, by getting the mincemeat and then boiling all the fat off it and then putting in good fats like olive oil. And I then got called in by the suits upstairs, who said that the Australian Meat Board or something like that was incredibly annoyed how dare I suggest that meat had fat in it, and therefore I had to do a story the very next day saying that meat had no fat. Now, at this stage, I had a degree in medicine and was also working part-time as a doctor in the kids' hospital, and so I then resigned and dropped my income by about $70,000 down to about $7,000 a year when I became a freelance science person. So it kind of hurt losing $62,000 a year, but on the other hand, I didn't do a story saying that meat had no fat, so I managed to keep some degree of integrity. My financial goals are really easy. Thanks to having been a medical doctor, I realise that most people never realise when they have enough. I have enough. I don't need more. I have enough. And now I'm able to, for example, when the car comes up for rego, I don't have to go out in the backyard and mix up a couple of cubic metres of spack filler to cover the rust, right? So my goals are to have enough, and I have enough, and I'm happy.
That's Dr. Karl Krzyzewski sharing his money wisdom on My Two Cents. What hasn't he achieved?
She was warm, funny, every student's favourite teacher.
No one ever suspects a woman could do such a thing, especially one with kids.
The parents trusted her too.
I felt that the school was a safe place. If anything was to happen, there would be somebody there.
But it was all a smokescreen.
She was brainwashing us from the start.
The Favourite, a five-part investigation from Background Briefing. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that is Life Matters today here on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. From all of the Life Matters team, I hope you're enjoying this break, maybe spending time with people you love, or maybe having some nice quality alone time. Either way, I'm glad that you've decided to share a bit of that time with me. I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.